Good morning. I'd like to call this meeting of House Education to order. It is Friday, February 12th, and it's 8:05 in the morning. President or Representative Munoz, Wilson, Edgman, Gardner, Book, and myself, Chair Seaton. And I'll remind everybody about their cell phones. We had one go off. Unfortunately, it was my wife, and so she made muffins for apology. So if you see us snacking, that's what we are looking at. And so that should serve as everyone's reminder. Today we're going to be looking at House Bill 297, post-secondary scholarships predominantly, and then we also ask the department to come in with an assessment or an analysis of assessments on work keys, because at least the and the alignment with our current curriculum, and also the correspondence between that and college preparatory exams, I'll call them ACT or SAT, in relationship to the GPS. So we will be getting to that portion later, but that's why we have requested that information. For the committee's information, I wanted to let everyone know that we have available the WIN training. I signed up for it and we had a technical glitch, but we have a copy of all the printouts. WIN is the younger age preparatory course for work keys, and there are a number of seminars going on about preparing and using that. We didn't pass these out. We're not going to use them today, but they're available. And so if anybody wants those or wants to see when those course trainings are, we have that available. So that is not directly related to the presentation we have today, but we've been working on that aspect for a while, and those trainings are ongoing. Those webinars is what they are. And any member can sign up for one that wishes to. Is there anything else committee members want to bring up before we get started? Okay, thank you, and we have with us today the Commissioner and Mr. Jeans. Would you, Director of School Finance, would you identify yourself? And what we are going to ask the Commissioner to do is go through a sectional analysis of the bill, or go through section by section, so we get a complete look at all sections of the bill. Because we had an overview of the main points before, but we didn't go through basically the bill as we've had it. As we go through, everybody should understand that we can go ahead and ask questions at that time as we go through, and then we'll delve in as deep as we want, just so we don't get off the track initially. I've requested that the department look at a mechanism for having a needs-based component, an add-on, and so what we'll do is try and hold that till the end. And I think other people have been looking at the needs-based component, but rather than stop the sectional analysis on the bill and go to something that isn't currently in the bill, we'll look at that portion as an add-on after we go through the sectional analysis of the bill. Does that work with your idea of where you're presenting, Mr. Commissioner?
Yes, Chair Seaton.
Okay, thank you. Would you go ahead and identify yourself for the record, and we will start here.
Thank you, Chair Seaton. For the record, my name is Larry Ledoux. I'm the Commissioner of the Department of Education and Early Development. Chair, I'm going to go through the law section by section and try to give a general overview and then respond to questions as they arise with regard to the specifics.
Okay, and that is House Bill 297. It should be in the packet that has the cover on it, if you don't have it separately, and it's version A. So everybody's got
it. It's in the same version.
We're ready to go.
Thank you, Chair Seaton. Section one outlines the district's determination of scholarship eligibility. It says that the school itself, the high school, will determine eligibility. This is a cost-effective way. So on a student's transcript, it would indicate whether the student has met the eligibility criteria. So that would be established by the secondary school that the student attends. Section two is...
Just a moment, we've got questions. Representative Gardner.
It just occurs to me, when a child takes, a student takes the SAT or an ACT, does the school district get those results, or does that just go to the student?
Through the chair, Representative Gardner, the results usually go to the school and are placed on the transcript. I suppose the student could take the test and not have the results sent to the school. But generally speaking, the student, when they apply, will designate what schools they go to, and usually the school where the test is taken. We'll get a sticker to put on the transcript that lists their achievement scores. In this case, to qualify, the student would have to authorize the high school to receive those scores, or they wouldn't be able to certify.
Thank you.
Okay. Thank you. Any other questions on Section 1? Section 2.
Thank you, Chair Seaton. Section 2 merely grants Department of Education Early Development the authority to act and manage the GPS program. Section 3 defines the functions and duties and powers of the Commission on Post-Secondary Education with regard to their role. They will be acting as the fiscal agents of the GPS, will monitor eligibility, dispense checks to colleges, and carry out all financial transactions with regard to the operation of the GPS program.
Mr. Chairman, we have a couple questions. Representative Wilson?
My question for that is on, and it kind of coincides with your fiscal note, and this one was dated 12-1, but it says that you're going to need an education specialist to help do the regulations and everything. Now, and then it looks like that just you're going to have that person for 1 year, and then you're not going to have them again. So who's going to be doing this?
Through the chair, that position will operate within the Department of Education. The regulations to govern the scholarship will be lengthy, and they will have to be moved through the State Board of Education through public hearing and in action. So that would be a position to create
so
those regulations.
So that would be a permanent position. Follow-up, sorry.
Representative Wilson.
So that would be a permanent position? Because it doesn't show that. And I was thinking it probably would need to be a permanent position.
Would you identify yourself for the record?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, Eddie Jeans, Director of School of Finance. That fiscal note will need to be amended to reflect that it's an ongoing position.
Okay,
yes.
Thank you.
Okay. Thank you. And Representative Gardner, did you also have a question?
Not at this point. Thank you.
Okay. And I had one. Here we're talking about in the section 030, the commission. Is that the Commission on Post-Secondary Education? I don't see a reference.
Yes, Chair Seaton.
Okay. Are there further questions on that section? Seeing none. Okay. Proceed, Mr. Commissioner.
Thank you, Chair Seaton. Section 4 is a lengthy one, and we'll just go through it step by step. So when you have questions, just stop me, or I'll just keep moving through it. Section 4A, the Governor's Performance Scholarship Program, is established to provide scholarship opportunities for Alaska resident high school graduates to attend a qualified post-secondary institution in the state. The program includes a merit-based academic and a merit-based career and technical school scholarship. The merit-based scholarship consists of three scholarship levels. The merit-based career and technical school scholarship consists of one award level.
Okay, well, let me stop you there. On line 15, it's established for resident high school graduates. My understanding was we also had homeschool students that would be eligible for this. Do they receive a high school diploma, or how is the mechanism that this incorporates more than graduates through the public high school with the public and is it only a public high school with a high school graduation diploma?
Chair Seaton, most homeschool programs offer, are affiliated through other organizations that have their own accreditation, who actually provide, you know, high school diplomas to their students. I imagine there are some programs out there where the student is not participating in any program other than what their parents teach them, and at that point in time, we're going to have to evaluate what that means with regard to their graduation. I think our intent is to make this available to every graduate in the state of Alaska, including homeschools, and, but generally, homeschool students are affiliated with some program. Many times, there's a group of parents that do not work through state correspondence programs. They don't want any affiliation, they don't take any money, they operate through their own programs, but they usually operate through an accredited program of their own choosing. They just pay for it themselves, and they offer a graduation diploma.
Okay, well, I want to flag this for the department, because we need to figure out where the sideboards are going to be on that, where, and we need to understand what diploma or graduation is. I know that we're going to have a test level that needs to be substantiating something there, but for us, we need to make sure that we have the wording in here right, so that we understand and the public understands exactly who can participate and can receive that. Mr. James.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. It is the intent of the department that this program is available to all high school graduates, whether they graduate from a homeschool program or whatever the program may be, a private school. If it was restricted to public high school graduates, we would have inserted the word public. And we will have to address how all those other students qualify for the scholarship through the regulatory process. I think the law would get way too cumbersome if we tried to include all that in the statute itself.
Okay, and that's fine, but for us passing the statute, we're going to have to at least have a framework of what's intended or not intended to be encompassed in those regulations, I think, because otherwise we're going to be getting a lot of feedback from people that don't understand what the intention of that really means. So if you would outline that for us and send us a memo on what's intended and who will be included, who will be excluded. I'm presuming from conversations we've had before that GEDs are being excluded, or if they're going to be included, we need to know that parameter as well, because there's a number of students who don't continue along the track and decide to take a GED. I think the Military and Youth Academy offers a GED, not a high school graduation diploma. They would be excluded if we had that, or maybe that's wrong. But we want to make sure that we know who's targeted and who is not. So, and that would be fine for a memo. We don't need to go into trying to those details now. Representative Wills.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. With this section, you're going to set up the guidelines of is this where the different grade averages come in?
Through the Chair, Representative Wilson, will be, as we work through this section, you'll see where we establish that law.
I have questions on that, so I'll wait.
Are there any further questions on A, on Section A here? Okay, go ahead, Mr. Commissioner.
Thank you, Chair Seaton. Under Section B, it really defines the two different roles between the Department of Education and the Alaska Commission on Post-Secondary Education. It indicates that we will work together. The Department of Education will take responsibility through the regulatory process to develop the operational guidelines. The Post-Secondary Commission, or excuse me, Alaska Commission on Post-Secondary Education, shall administer the daily operations of the program and financing of the program, including the procedures for applying for the scholarships, establishing standards for and ensuring continuing compliance with programmatic standards, and requiring students to apply for other non-loan financial aid consistent with federal law.
Does anybody have questions on any of that before we go on? It's a complicated paragraph. So basically, that just means that before someone can qualify for this, they have to have applied for any other available public, federal loans. Is that right, or non-loan?
Yes, Chair Seaton, that's correct. The legislation says that the merit scholarship program with the GPS will be the last to pay. It's not our intent to, and we've learned this from other states, to write students a check that goes beyond the cost, reasonable cost for attendance at college. So we designed that to be last to pay.
Okay, fine. Thank you.
Area C talks about the purpose of the GPS program, and I'm just going to highlight those very quickly because I think that they're very important as we move through the discussion. The purpose of the GPS program is increasing high school graduation rate in the state, improving academic performance of students in grades kindergarten through 12 in the state, improving preparedness for Alaska students for post-secondary education, improving the quality of the educational programs offered by high schools in the state, increasing the scores of high school students in the state on college entrance examinations, increasing job training opportunities in the state, improving the post-secondary academic achievement and graduation rate of students in the state, and expanding the pool of high school students in the state who pursue post-secondary opportunities.
Okay, are there any questions on that? So backing up just a little bit where we have under B, we have the programmatic standards. The department will design the programmatic standards for scholarships and appeals, and that you can modify the programmatic standards. Can you give me the definition or the kind of the global look of what programmatic standards means?
The programmatic standards, I believe, would be the scores on the test, the ACT or the work keys or whatever exam that was used to determine the standardized evaluation, if you will. That would be a programmatic standard. As it's written right now, that it could include what the actual GPA is, although our intent is to follow the governor's guidelines in the proposal, or A, B plus, C plus, with regard to the law.
Is there any further expansion on what programmatic standards would mean?
Yes, Mr. Chairman. The other...
Mr. James.
Eddie James, Director of School Finance. The other programmatic standards would be listing out the courses that would qualify in meeting the math requirements, the four-year math requirements, the four-year science requirements, 4 years of English. It's our intent that what we would do is put together a menu of courses that students could select from to meet those requirements instead of specific four courses that students would be required to take.
And on those, I think maybe Representative Wilson has a question too, but on those, are there going to be ways to qualify for the like end of test scores or challenge scores that give credit for whether it's English or math or whatever kind of course that is, or is this, again, seat time kind of blockage, or how do we accomplish the variability across the state? And I guess virtual classes would be in there. So is challenging a class anticipated to be one of the mechanisms for meeting those goals?
Chair Seaton, school districts are responsible for determining whether the student has achieved, you know, the information that we want them to know and be able to do in a particular course. I think that part of the programmatical standards discussion will be how to translate standards-based scores. There are some districts in the state that do not give letter grades, and the department or the State Board of Education is going to have to develop a methodology to translate that into a grade score. And they're used to that because colleges demand that also. So they have an algorithm in place to do so. And I believe that is our intent. And you mentioned credit by exam or credit by competence. That's really up to the districts to determine how they award competency in a grade. We don't manage that as a department. We rely on districts to make those decisions on behalf of their children. But we do feel very strongly that this is a reform effort, and students need to show competence or complete successfully three years of social studies, 4 years of math, 4 years of science, 4 years of English language arts. And we do not want to waive those standards, but we'll leave it up to the district to specifically determine how the student has achieved those. As Mr. Jeans has pointed out, we will develop a list of courses that lead to a college preparation. One of the goals is to make sure that these young people are ready to be successful in college. So the key word here is rigor. Whether you do it with an exam or you translate a standards-based diploma, we need rigor for this program to be successful.
Okay, we have two questions. Representative Munoz and then Wilson.
Thank you. So what will we do with students that complete the curriculum, receive, say, an A average, but then test out at a lower score?
Through the chair, Representative Munoz, the law says, as it's written, that they must meet all three criteria in order to qualify for a scholarship. So they would have to have a GPA as indicated, you know, in the law. They would have to have a certain score on an achievement test of some sort, and they would have to, let's see, grade points, curriculum, and test score. They would have to meet all. The first criteria we would look at would be whether they took the rigorous courses that we require. Then you would look at GPA, and that would limit, you know, if you had a lower GPA, that would limit the type of scholarship, and a test score would limit the level of scholarship.
Follow-up, Representative Munoz.
The student has completed the curriculum and has an A, but tests out at the equivalent of a C+. So would they then get a B?
Through the chair, they would receive a C+ scholarship at this point. Again, you start with the curriculum. If they meet that, then the next you'd go to the assessment score or their GPA to determine where they're actually going to fall in the scholarship category.
And just for the committee's understanding, I think that Representative Munoz is looking at the handout where it says sample across of it. As far as, I guess, these are programmatic standards. Is that correct?
That would be correct, Mr. Chairman.
Okay. Representative Munoz, follow up.
And you may not have it right now, but if we could get an analysis of your scoring matrix for the SAT and ACT, and how they compare to requirements of schools across the country. Looking at these scores, they seem high to me, but I can't say for certain. So if you could give us more feedback on what, say, a competitive school in the lower 48 is looking for in terms of average scores for students that are admitted, and then maybe comparing to our in-state system as well.
Through the chair, Representative Munoz, these are just samples. In no way are we suggesting that these scores would be what would be set by the State Board of Education. They were just, we completed this matrix so you can see how that all three criteria work together. But with regard to the assessment scores, those are just random, if you will.
Okay, and if you want some of that information of how our students are comparing with students from other states, Mr. Morris is going to be up later, and he might be able to give us some of that information. Representative Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. If this is just an idea of what the scores would be, I'm looking at the GPA, and if I was a student, I think that there will be a lot of students that will choose the career technical career track, and this says, well, for the other ones that are C plus average or less, there's a lot of those kids that will get A's, but they just chose a different career track a carpenter or something like that. And so I think if you could word this different right here, because this would be insulting to me if I was a student that had chosen to go one direction but I got all A's. This kind of insinuates that those kids are going to only be C average kids, and that's so if you could just word this, figure out how to word this so that it doesn't look that way.
Through the chair, Representative Wilson, we will do that.
Okay, thank you.
I certainly don't want to project that.
Thank you. And Representative Edgman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Is the secondary goal of this whole program to also direct students to Alaskan institutions of higher learning?
Through the chair, Representative Edgman, yes. One of the purposes of the program is to ensure that, or hope that, Alaskan students will take the opportunity to be educated in Alaska, because we know if they are, they will stay here and contribute to our workforce needs in the state.
And just as a
Representative Edgman.
So is that listed, and maybe I'm not reading this close enough, in section 4D of the 8 goals?
It doesn't look like it, Representative Edgman.
But follow up, but it probably should be, though.
I
mean, if you're looking at 400 million, 5%, that's what, 20 million a year? That's going to be a pretty good redirecting of students to Alaskan institutions. So.
Good. I see an amendment coming, right? Representative Edgman, would you?
Yes, page 4. I'll work with the commissioner.
Pardon?
I'll work with the commissioner.
Good. That's fine. And I guess I'm still a little stuck on the programmatic standards, but the districts are going to determine how they're met, and the homeschool students in the curriculum. I'm trying to figure out how those all mesh together. I'd like to see something from the department on, you know, your direction, not direction to the board, to the state board, but your kind of proposal to the state school board as to how we're going to accomplish these things for challenging courses and everything. Because the way I read it, and I think the way a lot of school boards are going to read this, is this is these courses and you must take those in the traditional way. And so I think that I'm concerned that we have more breadth, whether it's in here or whether it's in explanatory memo, of how we're going to accomplish to reach to those non-traditional students, or how we are giving permission to the districts when we're saying it's 4 years of mathematics, 4 years of science, 4 years of English, 3 years of social studies, how we're making sure that they understand that there are flexible ways in which they can accomplish and define those, because I think that some districts are going to read them as the classes from this menu of classes to accomplish the science or accomplish the mathematics, and so I just want to make sure that we get that. Representative Wilson.
I have one more question, and I thank you very much. Right now, many, many, many schools are graduating kids that need remedial classes when they get to college, and hopefully this is going to make a difference so that and maybe it'll take a few years for this to happen, but I don't know. But I think it's our intention would be that we would be eliminating a lot of those remedial classes in the colleges. So I'm going to make a statement now that may not be true, because I don't know. But when you make your rules and regulations for the schools, when they get to do it the way they want to, are we going to have some teeth in that so they can't pass kids so that they really do have the rigorous training that we want them to have, or the school, the classes, or whatever?
Through the chair, Representative Wilson, that's precisely why the achievement test is a part of this. There's a link between the rigor of courses and their performance on these tests. Rigor is very important. It's not our intent in any way, even through some of the analysis that we will present to this committee, to lower the expectation for rigor. Because not only if we're successful, will we have fewer remedial courses at the college level? We'll have a greater number of kids who stay and graduate, because if they go to college thinking they're prepared, and they're not, that's failure. And many people deal with failure by leaving. We want our young people to be ready to go and to have what it needs to engage in a four-year college program. Right now, many of them take 5 years or 6 years. And if you're paying the bill as a parent, you know that that's very expensive. So our intent is that this program act as a reform for education. When I visit rural schools, I ask the kids. I usually ask the adults to leave so I can talk to the young people. And I ask them what they're going to do, and they say, we're going to college. In one village I visited, two were going to be nurses. Two were going to be teachers. One was going to go be a diesel mechanic. One was trying to decide whether they were going to be a beautician or a nurse. I'm not sure about the training for a beautician, but I know that we need to deliver to these young people the curriculum that they need to be successful in college. It's not right that we give them a dream. And the program that the governor has outlined in this proposal is a college prep program. It's fairly typical, 4 years of math, 4 years of science. And if we have young people all across Alaska that are having a dream to go to college, it's time we started throwing down the gauntlet and asking principals and superintendents and communities to find ways to deliver these programs to young people that are rigorous. And it's going to be very different. Chair Seaton is very right. We're going to have to define, you know, some alternatives and what that will involve, because we're going to have to support these districts. But I believe they can do it. Many of them are doing it right now. And our young people in rural Alaska and urban have proven to us that if we provide the opportunity, they're up to the task to meet these requirements. But to lower the rigor of these courses, or to make it so easy that the merit scholarship has no teeth to it, or I don't like to use the word teeth, but has no accountability, would defeat the very purpose of the program. We want kids to work hard, and they will rise to the level that we want.
Just one follow-up. Thank you. And I guess you, in your regulations, you'll have to do that, because obviously it's happening now. I don't know how you guys will make your regulations so that we are making sure that the kids know what they need to go by the time. I'm not sure just taking these classes, and this is great, but I'm not sure just taking these classes will ensure that they're ready for college. And I would like to be assured of that. And I know you probably can't, but do you know where I'm coming from here?
Through the chair, Representative Wilson, I do. And again, the purpose of the assessment score, for instance, the ACT, is a very good predictor of how a child will do their first year of college. It's not a predictor on whether they'll graduate. Grades are the predictor of graduation. But the ACT is a very good predictor, and it's well validated, I can show that easily, of how the child will do their first year of college. Okay. And I believe that if they do well their first year of college, you know, they'll have a greater success rate. But, you know, it's really all three. Grades are important because they indicate a student's perseverance, their ability to work hard, to take direction, to follow through. And that persistence that they have to get good grades follows through and is a predictor for graduation from college. And the research shows that grades, whether they're at a what we would call a high-end school on the East Coast or in one of our smaller schools, the impact is the same. They both require the same kind of diligence. But that's why we have an assessment test, is to make sure that these courses that they offer in high schools are rigorous and not just courses.
And I'd just like to reiterate what we had looked at before when we looked at Aldine School District, the winner of the Broad Prize, and one of the key elements that they had was every teacher in the district had to take, you know, a professional development course on what grades meant. Because if we have students across the state and across the district and within the school, and grades mean different things coming from different classrooms. One, it's your attendance and is very important. Another is if you're antsy and aren't sitting in your chair, it's, you know, if that's the grade instead of the knowledge, we, you know, it's going to be very frustrating to this program if we're using GPA and those grades in the schools don't have the similar meaning, and we found the information pretty well in the graduation work group that one of the reasons kids get very discouraged is because grades mean so many different things in so many different classrooms. So that may be one of the things that's going to grow out of this is the you know, the school reforms, I think, are going to happen because people are going to be required by the parents in communities to prepare kids to receive these scholarships. So anyway, proceed.
Thank you, Chair Seaton. I'm going to move to line 17 on page 4, the qualifications of applicants. Qualifications for the Governor's Performance Scholarship, you have to intend to apply for admission to an institution. You must be an Alaska resident. Under Alaska resident, who will graduate, has graduated or will graduate no later than 6 months after the date of the application from high school in the state, including a public, private school, and home school. So you have to be a resident and you have to be a graduate of an Alaska program, whether it's homeschool, public, or private. You can apply before 6 months, which makes sense. You haven't graduated yet before you graduate, and there is no requirement that you apply, you know, within 2 months of graduation for eligibility. The high school will determine your eligibility. You have to, under item 3, will receive and utilize the scholarship at a qualified post-secondary institution in state. You can be granted an extension of time allowed by the department for purposes of this paragraph. Standards for extension of time must include time while the student was in military service or meets other minimum qualifications to apply or continue to be eligible for the Governor's Performance Scholarship. If you're in the military, we can grant you extra time. If you're a dependent of Alaska resident who's transferred out of state because of the military, it provides for that access too. It's very military friendly in terms of the bill.
I have a question.
Representative Wills.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Is that going to be, I can totally understand that for somebody that was here for 10 years and then they leave, but what about all the people that come up here and are in the military because they've been transferred from the lower 48 up to here and then they go back? And many of them apply and say they're going to be residents of the state so they can get the permanent fund. So we have a lot of those that have permanent. Are you just going to say they can all do that too? Or, I mean, I just want to know, kind of understand what the requirements are.
Through the chair, Representative Wilson, it's our intent to, I would say, and I'll have to be more specific, to review residency as residency. And if they're in the military and they claim Alaska as a resident and are transferred out and still claim it, then we would treat them as a resident of the state of Alaska.
And what is, maybe there's a definition section of resident that you're using for this?
I'm going to have to, through the chair, or Chair Seaton, I'm going to have to find exactly where it talks about it. It refers to a law.
Oh, 110.055.
What page were you on?
My eye just fell on it. It's page 4, line 1. Meets the eligibility for residency as described in 0110055. And if the chair wishes.
I would appreciate that. Yep.
Shall I read it, Mr. Chair?
Please do.
A person establishes residency in the state by being physically present in the state with the intent to remain in the state indefinitely and to make a home in the state. A person demonstrates the intent required under Section A of this section by maintaining a principal place of abode in the state for at least 30 days or for a longer period, if a longer period is required by law or regulation, and by providing other proof of intent as may be required by law or regulation, which may include proof that the person is not claiming residency outside the state or obtaining benefits under a claim of residency outside the state. A person who establishes residency in the state remains a resident during an absence from the state, unless during the absence the person establishes or claims residency in another state.
Okay, so we're talking about the 30-day residency requirement, as long as you don't take up voter residency, basically, in another state. Is that
Mr. Chairman?
Yes, Representative Edgman.
Well, that begs the question, then. If you use the permanent fund database to be a resident, and I may be wrong on this, but to get your PFD, you have to be in the state from January 1 to December 31. Would you have a situation where you have a family that came into Alaska in February, and they weren't eligible for their PFD as per the database for PFD, but still be eligible for this program?
Through the chair, Representative Edgman, at this point, you would be eligible 30 days if you graduate. If you were here 30 days and you graduated from an Alaska high school, private school, or homeschool program. But I think it's important to note that the law says that can be changed by regulation. Mm-hmm. So it's the law provides the minimum framework, but as Representative Gardner read it, the State Board of Education can modify that through regulation to extend it if they want to, as I understand it.
So, Mr. Chairman, the obvious inference is that you wouldn't use the PFD database in terms of residency then? I mean, that just...
Through the chair, Representative Edgman, no.
Representative Wills.
So, thank you, Mr. Chairman. So, if I'm going to give you a little scenario here, somebody lives in the lower 48 and they hear about this wonderful program, and so they send their kids up to live with grandma for 30 days. Live with grandma for 30 days, and they go back, and then they can come here and get this advantage.
They would have to graduate from high school or a homeschool high school.
Well, if they did it during the last month of school, would that be possible?
Through the chair, Representative Wilson, yes. As I indicated before, in creating the bill, we tried to create a framework of law so that the legislature wouldn't have to come back and change it if it was too specific. So within the law, we established, you know, that definition of residency, with the assumption that the State Board of Education has the power to modify that if we start having a problem, as you've suggested.
Follow up, Representative Wilson.
I am concerned about that, and I think maybe you better get some of those rules and regulations figured out before we start having a problem. So because I think that could be very easily done, and you know, I really don't see any reason why we couldn't say just same rules as for the PFD, and with some allowances for different, you know. But then, don't ask me, but I just think that we have to watch those kind of things, or we'll be paying for kids from out of state coming up here and going to school. And they won't probably stay here. They probably will go back to where they really are living.
Commissioner Ledoux, and then we'll go to Representative Munoz.
To the chair, Representative Wilson, I will reconvene a meeting with our Assistant Attorney General with regard to this particular piece of legislation and report back to the committee on that topic.
And just interjecting on this topic, would you all also find out if someone can graduate from high school more than once? If we're allowing home school graduation and someone graduates from another state, let's say, and then decides they want to take advantage of this scholarship, could they be here, satisfy the ACT requirements, have their parents certify that they have fulfilled the mathematics and all these things, and then have graduated through the homeschool program, and then qualify for this with a 30-day or longer residency.
Chair Seaton, I've, in my entire experience as a secondary educator, I've never enrolled, or nor do I think anyone has enrolled, a student whose transcript shows that they graduated from a high school, but we will check into that, because I don't know if there's a law that speaks to that or not.
Thank you, and especially since we have a provision in here that says you don't have to be going to a public high school, you don't have to have a transcript, because homeschoolers don't have to have a transcript. We're working on a flexible program, and we need it flexible, but we need to know what the parameters are to that flexibility and what the, like I said in resources the other day, I'm a fisherman, so you know my job has always been to figure out ways around regulations. So
I may be admitted.
So just looking at this, trying to figure it out. And then we have Representative Munoz and then Gardner.
Thank you. On the non-residency versus residency requirements, the university has, of course, non-resident tuition and resident tuition. And I don't think it's enough just to be here and live with grandma for 30 days to get residency tuition rates. I think there are provisions that require independence, as taxpayer status independence from your parents in order to get
and can that be part of your analysis as to how this is going to interact with either the university, the private universities, or the certificated program in Alaska? And I know you can't probably do the whole universe of them, but we have AvTech, we have these, and if we have a resident, non-resident kind of tuition-based program.
Thank you, Mr. Yes. Chair. Two things. I had occasion recently to look up the rules, at least at Anchorage School District, about enrolling a child whose parents are not resident, and you have to pay tuition if you do, and so if the parents are out of state and the child comes up here and the parents are not a resident, the child has to pay tuition to go to high school, unless somebody else has guardianship.
Right.
So that could be done, but it is a factor. I'm a little bit puzzled about the description of the exemption of military families from, not exactly exemption from residency, but I just like to talk about a scenario. If a family is transferred out, say the child's on track for a GPS scholarship and the family's transferred out and the child doesn't actually graduate from high school here, maybe it's the last semester of high school. Is that what you're saying, or are we talking about a child who's graduated and then the family transfers, and I don't know why the child wouldn't stay here to go to school if that's the intent. Yeah. What is the military exemption for the children?
Through the chair, Representative Gardner, I'm going to have to answer you fully at a later date and in writing. I don't want to say something here on a scenario that may not be correct. So I'll go over the language and send it to you, and I'll try to respond to your scenario. There are many, many, you know, of those, of course. But instead of trying to answer that one, I'll just give you the information specifically.
Thank you. And just for the record, I think we need to be firm that kids have to graduate in Alaska. You don't, even if your parents are transferred out, if you graduate somewhere else, I don't see that we want to grandfather people who actually graduate out of state into our program.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. And if that is the intent of the regulations to allow that, then the question also becomes on at what point? Is it the last semester? Is it as a sophomore, they leave and then they graduate and would qualify under this exemption? Mm-hmm. You know, it's just the parameters that we want to get. And Commissioner, feel free on any of these things. I mean, they're complicated issues. We've got this for a while. We want to get right. And if you get a question just like this one, feel free to say that, you know, we'll get it back to us in writing with more explanation, because we want to get it right instead of quick. Although we never mind rapid responses either. Does anyone else have any other questions on the qualifications section on the military service. I guess the only, the extension of time, is that the extension of time to utilize the scholarship or the extension of time to qualify? It's just a little unclear. So if you would include that in your memo to us on that exemption, that would be great.
Chair Seaton, under item 3, it talks about the 6 years of eligibility. And if a student is in the military and not in the state, serving in the military, that we can extend that 6 years of eligibility if they've earned it in Alaska. So if they've established their eligibility and they end up in the military, they can be granted an extension of the 6 years.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Edgman.
I guess while we're still on this section, again, $400 million, 5% annual earnings, that's what, $20 million a year. Commissioner, have you calculated it as a maximum $3,000 a scholarship, how many awards that would actually make available, and in terms of ballparking it for now, and how many students are theoretically could at the maximum level participate in this program? And I guess where I'm going, and just simply for discussion purposes, Mr. Chairman, we'll await the, well, maybe just have you ask that, and I'll follow up with another question, if you would, please.
Through the chair, Representative Edgman, we've done some modeling based on the use of the Hathaway scholarships in Wyoming, because they have a similar size state and a similar university system that we do, although they have community colleges, I think that we do too in sort of a way. But so we can make that modeling available to you.
So, but how many
Representative Edgman.
Yeah, there's a follow-up. How many, what are we talking here, 20 million to the three grand? I mean, how many students is that? What's the range here?
Just under 4,000.
You know, what's the demand picture look like to the extent that your model can demonstrate that?
Through the chair, Representative Edgman, we'll give you a copy of our spreadsheet modeling that we've done that indicates the number of students that we're predicting at each scholarship, at each level, and at each amount, including the total amount. But I think our modeling indicates after full implementation, we expect about 6,000 students roughly to be participating in the program in the various different categories, because the 3,000 only applies to the career and technical scholarship. The gold scholarship approaches $5,000. And so when you, and we'll provide that. We have that document prepared.
And if I could just follow up.
Follow up, Representative Edgman.
Mr. Chairman, so what I'm hearing from you, I didn't get any numbers out of that, but obviously when I look at the model, I'll get a better idea. But where I'm going with this is, you know, again, let's say $20 million available every year. The chances are you're probably not going to award $20 million every year, right. or probably even close to that. So for discussion purposes, and maybe at a later time, but I'd like for us to think about maybe going beyond you know, the 6 months, the date of application for high school, maybe considering kids who've been out of the system for a year or so. And why, you know, you got kids that sit out for a year but still have every intention of going to school, and you know, why wouldn't they not be eligible for this?
Yeah. Through the chair, Representative Edgman, are you talking about kids that, for instance, graduated last year and to be eligible for the scholarship, or are you talking about, because there's no requirement that a child go for take advantage of the scholarship within 6 months. The way it's written now, a child who qualifies could actually go outside, get a four-year degree. Mm-hmm. They would still have 2 years of eligibility. They could go to graduate school or attend full-time and another degree in Alaska. So they wouldn't lose it.
Okay, so maybe I misunderstood. So, thank you, Mr. Chairman.
And within that six-year time frame, are we there, or are you? Is that coming up? Is this the point?
Through the chair, I was just getting ready to talk about what would disqualify you from applying.
Okay, go ahead.
All right.
That'll be
A student who is not qualified to receive a governor's performance scholarship if the person has not complied with the regulations under the Military Selective Service Act. They're currently in default or owes a refund on a federal financial aid loan under the Federal Guaranteed Student Loan Program or financial aid awarded under this chapter. Or three, has been convicted of a felony in the state or another jurisdiction and has not qualified for a waiver under standards adopted by the department. Item three is there to look at the extenuating circumstances of a young person who has made a felonious mistake. and the department would develop criteria to, for them to apply for eligibility.
Okay. So the six-year time period, you said if they were still in qualified something. I mean, my understanding is if you sign up, you can take a world trip for a year. I mean, there's not a there's not a thing that you have to be outside as a full-time student in another institution to come back. I just want to make this clarify for myself. It's within the 6 years, you have 8 semesters to be able to utilize it. Is that right?
Chair Seaton, you're absolutely correct. You have 6 years of eligibility, and within that 6 years, you have 8 semesters of funded scholarship. So you could be out of the state if you initially qualified for 5 years, and you would have 1 year left to utilize the money.
And I would just like to point out, since we're talking about this, that all the data is that if you go right out of high school and go right to college, you are much more likely to graduate from college than if you have a break and leave. Even coming back to college, your tendency to actually graduate from college, the statistics are you're much less likely to do it. So I wouldn't want to encourage anybody to take that break, because that break has consequences, and one of the major consequences is that your likelihood of graduation from college goes down at a very rapid pace. So any questions? Representative Wilson.
Thank you. On page 5, line 10, I don't know what that is, but I assume that that's an unhonorable discharge.
Through the chair, Representative Wilson, it means that you did not sign up for the draft.
Oh. Okay.
You have to register when you're 18.
All right.
Or you're not eligible for federal.
Gender-specific, though, right?
You know, I had 4 sons, Chair Seaton. I do not know about young women registering, but I know all 4 sons had to.
Okay.
I'll find out, Chair Seaton, if you'd like to know.
So, I know. Okay. any other questions there? And we'll go on to 17.
Thank you, Chair Seaton. We've reviewed these criteria before, but this section establishes the criteria for the academic scholarship, the core curriculum, the minimum GPA, and again, our minimum GPA that the governor has articulated a number of times as of I. We're looking at an A scholarship or A average scholarship, a B plus, and a C plus. And I want to remind the committee that this is in a rigorous curriculum. So some people might look at a C-plus and say, what's that? Well, we're talking about young people that are entering into a college prep program, and we're trying to invite people to work hard. So a C-plus in this curriculum for many young people is going to be quite an accomplishment and should be recognized. So I want to make that clear.
And what – I don't see it on the spreadsheet here. What is a average
Chair Seaton, in our definition that we'll be bringing forward to you, it would be 3.5 GPA or above.
Okay. And so a B then is?
I believe it would be a 3-point GPA to 3.50 or 4.9, depending on how we roll the hair splitting. Okay. And a C-plus would be... I'm just guessing right now, 2.5 or 3-point, but I would have to go check our notes on that. 2.5 to 3.
Okay. Thank you. And let's see, where are we? Okay. Any questions on those? Okay. Thank you. Yes, Representative Munoz.
Does the University of Alaska require SAT or ACT scores?
Through the chair, Representative Munoz, the University of Alaska requires that you take the ACT or the SAT in order to be admitted to the university. They do not have a minimum score that they use, but they do require students to take it. I actually have a copy. I can make the committee where I printed out their requirements for admission, if the committee would like.
Okay, that would be good, because I know they use an AccuPlacer exam in some of the, is that different, does that vary by campus?
No, I think the actual law says the ACT, SAT are an exam approved by the university, and it could be the AccuPlacer, I'm not sure.
Okay, yeah, because I know that, you'll follow up with us. Okay, thank you. Representative Munoz.
Again, I know you said that these standards are flexible for the SAT and ACT, but how are you going to establish those guidelines? How are you going, are they going to be compared to what competitive institutions outside of Alaska are requiring, since Alaska does not have, the UA system does not have minimum requirements for those exams? How will those criteria, how will that criteria be established?
With the chair, Representative Munoz, the way the law is written, the State Board of Education would set those standards, but I will say up front that we're going to have to be very careful how we set those, because the misuse of assessments is rampant in our country, and we have to be careful that the exam doesn't become an artificial barrier because of some of the weaknesses that it, that are inherent to these kinds of exams. Cultural bias is one.
Right.
They don't necessarily fit. So we're going to have to take a very, very close look. The law does not say what the score would be, which is prudent, because the SAT just reset their scores. And so if you put it in law, you'd have to come back and change the law. So the State Board of Education, through their regulatory process, is able to act more expeditiously to change a regulation than you can to change a law. So I think that as we move through that process, we're going to have to be very, very careful and have the minimum score necessary to validate the grading program to make sure that kids are ready to enter and succeed in college. I'm not looking for the highest. We're looking for a rigorous program we want kids to be in, but I don't want anything artificial that prevents kids from attending college that doesn't fit the goals of the program. So there is a natural suspicion that we have regarding these within the department that's very healthy, and I can assure you that that will be reflected, you know, as the department or the State Board of Education moves forward.
Further questions? Representative Gardner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It's not about any particular area we've been talking about, but are we confident that if this were passed and implemented in the near future, that students all over the state would really have a fair chance to select and take the necessary rigorous classes?
Through the chair, Representative Gardner, I think that some students are going to have to work harder based on where they live. If a student who wants to learn to play a violin is going to have a difficult time if there's no teacher where they live. And I think that schools are going to have to work very hard. But I think what's really unfair is to assume that young people, because of where they live, can never have the opportunity to apply and show what they can do. Fairness is an interesting concept, but I think opportunity is available to all students in the state. We're going to have to work hard. It's a challenge. But it bothers me that people are so concerned, and again, I want to emphasize that your question is not what I'm responding to, but it bothers me that questions regarding children's performance on the scholarship is related to the college curriculum that we want them to take. Because as I said earlier today, we have a number of young people out there who dream and have the vision of going and attending college. And what the Governor's Performance Scholarship does is it invites them to work harder to obtain that curriculum. And so when people say they can't do it, what they're really saying is, I can't deliver a program so these kids can have a dream to go to college. And I believe that schools and principals and communities have sufficient resources to make sure that young people have an opportunity. It's not the same. My sons who grew up in Kodiak did not have even close to the opportunities that young people have in Anchorage. But there are advantages that we have that other communities don't have. And if you when I visit rural Alaska and I see a sense of community and ownership and the closeness and bonding, there's advantages that far outweigh some of the opportunities in communities that are hard to describe if you don't live there. But I believe that we have the opportunity for young people to access, and they demand that. And when you listen to these young people talk about what they want to do, it just pushes us all the more to say, it's about time that we provided these opportunities. And I believe there are sufficient distance resources, different ways of teaching, leadership resources. And I've talked to a number of superintendents from rural Alaska, and my question is, can you do this? And they say, absolutely. When I asked a principal in rural Alaska, can you deliver this? He said, it's going to be challenging, but we can do it. Our kids deserve it, the opportunity. So this is a reform bill as much as it is a scholarship. It's a contract with kids. It says, we believe in you enough as a state that you can prepare yourself to be successful in college. But what is wrong, again, is to put a dream in these child's heads, if you will, and not deliver the instruction that will allow them to be successful.
Follow-up, Representative Gardner.
Thank you. I mean, I understand about providing a path for children to achieve their dreams, but more than that, I think what we want to do is plant the seed for a child who might not think today that there's a possibility of going to college and make that realistic. But my question is actually really specific. If you're a child today in some tiny community that out in this state, is it really realistic and practical? Can that student actually take 4 years of science today or next year if this is in place?
Through the chair, Representative Gardner, I believe the answer is yes.
Okay.
I believe our distance, we've checked with our distance schools. They said they can deliver anywhere in the state and have the capability to do so. I think small districts are developing relationships to do so, and I know they're thinking about it right now. I heard one principal say, we only offer 2 years of math. My response was, why? Okay.
Well, that's my point, and through the chair.
Representative Gardner.
The districts may, I mean, the capability to offer it may be there, but can every student, does every student have the equipment, and do we have the technology currently functioning in every community to allow reception of what the state can offer?
Through the chair, Representative Gardner, I think the word is yes. I think if we pass this bill, as I said, it's a reform bill. It's going to cause some changes that should have taken place a long time ago. So maybe not now, but it will happen because communities are going to start demanding that schools deliver what we promise. These communities are going to start saying, why can't our kids have 4 years of math? You know, this community over here does it. And I want to say, too, that we have a lot of kids in urban Alaska who are not even close to working to their potential or taking care of the opportunity. I liked what you said earlier because it's very true. This is an invite for young people at a very early age to start thinking about what they want to do with their life and career and to prepare for it. And we want that invitation to be all over Alaska. And you know what? If we're honest about building the education system that we fund, we should have that common expectation around the state.
Follow-up, Representative Gardner.
Actually, it's a slightly different question, but related.
Is it on this section, or is it?
It's not on any. Well, it is on a section. I can dig it out. I'm not sure which section. It's a pretty quick question.
Okay.
If you're a student today in a really small community in Alaska, and you're not, you know, realistically can't access a rural hub, how do you take the SAT and the ACT today? If you live in Igiagig or someplace teeny.
Through the chair, Representative Gardner, the SAT is administered in every school in the state.
Okay.
The school registers for it, it's delivered, and it just has to be proctored. They don't, so every school is a testing center. On the other hand, if a community did not feel they wanted to do that, they could always move the young people to a central hub, but that's never advisable because kids are uncomfortable when they're not at home.
Okay. So. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Go ahead and proceed.
Let me see here.
Where are we lost in the section?
I think I was on number 4, page 6, line 3, enrollment in a course of study at a qualified university or college in the state that is intended. So for the academic scholarship, it's a college or university in Alaska that leads to a certificate or degree. Okay. Item 5 is fairly clear. In order to maintain the scholarship, you have to maintain a certain GPA. to maintain your scholarship. But if you lose it, you can, there'll be a process in there for a student to regain it. Not all of us, or not all students are sensible always when they go to school, and they have low times. And but we're not going to fund students who are not taking advantage of the scholarship. So if you lose it, you can regain it.
Okay, and where have we covered the loss? Did I miss that? The criteria for losing eligibility for a scholarship?
Chair Seaton, we have not covered it so far.
Is that someplace further, or?
The intent is to use post-secondary's current system.
Just 2.5.
I think so.
You can get back to us on that with the memo, but that would be a question on, I mean, we're talking about somebody losing eligibility, but we need to know kind of what that requires.
Chair Seaton, it was the intent, and we'll get a memo back to you, to use the same criteria the university uses for their honors scholarship.
Okay.
Which we believe is a maintenance of a 2.5, but we'll get back to you to be accurate.
Okay, thank you. Further questions on that? Go ahead and proceed.
Item 6, and we've talked about this earlier, and we'll be getting information back to you, a process through which a homeschooled or a private schooled student may submit evidence to the qualified university or college that establishes the equivalent of a high school diploma, grade point average, and core academic curriculum for schools. The next section talks about the career and technical school scholarship, and I'm just going to highlight that the academic requirements are the same for math, for language arts, for science, 3 social studies, but not necessarily the same courses. There is not an intent to have a student who is moving on a career track to take calculus or physics, but we do believe that they should be taking 4 years of math and science and language arts. The career and technical education is a high-tech field. The standards are very high, but we would have a set of courses, and we would work with districts and correspondence schools to have a set of courses that would meet this requirement, that would lead to the preparation that we require to be successful in a career and technical education field.
Representative Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For small schools that might have only one math teacher, is it possible to have two? I mean, there probably would be the first 2 courses of math would be the same, but then the next 2 would be different. The last 2 years would be different or something. Can one math teacher do all of that? I don't know.
Through the chair, Representative Wilson, it's very difficult for one teacher to do many things. But we have found through the use of distance delivery options, career, you know, centers, or learning centers, if you will, that those needs can be met. It is always difficult. Especially in rural Alaska, for a teacher not only to teach more than one math course, but to teach other courses as well beyond math. But that's where distance and e-learning are stepping to the plate.
Okay, thank you.
I have a question. The way number 6 reads here, process through which homeschooled or private school student may submit evidence to the qualified university or college that establishes the equivalent of a high school diploma. The college itself, the University of Alaska, offers GED programs, and there's a number of students that take those, and so obviously they've established with the University of Alaska that they've got the equivalent of a high school diploma. Do we have I'm hearing several different things, and one of them is a GED will not qualify you, and here it looks like a GED will qualify you. So at some point I really need a much more detailed explanation of GEDs, especially those that are offered by the University of Alaska campuses for students that are taking college there to then go on and proceed utilizing that as their criteria for meeting that requirement.
Thank you, Chair Seaton. We will provide that analysis, but it was not the intent of this bill to use GED as a track to using these scholarships. Some states allow that. This was not designed to do that. So I'll give you the analysis, but this section was not intended to grant a pathway to students who obtain a GED into the Governor's Performance Scholarship, because again, the criteria is rigor, you know, preparation. Some states have interpreted that differently, but this law, as it's written, does not include a GED pathway, and we will give you the analysis that you requested.
Mr. Chairman?
Representative Edgemon.
A couple of questions on Section 6. Commissioner, on line 8, it says to the qualified university or college that establishes the equivalent of a high school diploma. This college, is that an all-encompassing term that includes merit-based career and technical school scholarships?
Mr. Chair, Representative Edgemon, this section deals with academic scholarships, so we're looking at colleges or universities who are regionally accredited.
Fine enough, then. The phrase, the equivalent of a high school diploma, I notice it's not in the definition section of the bill, and the assumption is that it doesn't need to be in the definition section because it's already defined appropriately enough. Is that correct?
To the Chair, Representative Edgemon, yes.
Okay. Thank you.
And I presume that's going to be in the analysis that you're going to do back to us on the University of Alaska granted or prepared and granted GEDs. Okay.
Okay, looking at the eligibility for a career and technical school scholarship, I'm just highlighting the major points. As I said, the curriculum demands will be the same. The GPA.
Can we back up for one moment on that analysis that you're going to give us? Could you also give us the numbers that you would look at as far as the expanded population if it did include GEDs that were issued by the University of Alaska? In other words, in the analysis of a college or a university that establishes the equivalent of a high school diploma, that's the information that's done. If University of Alaska GEDs qualified for that language, how much of an expansion of the population of Alaska students would that be? In other words, how many University of Alaska GEDs are issued each year? I know there's a number, but I don't know what that number is. So just in the analysis that you do is fine. Thank you.
Okay, as I indicated, the programmatical requirements are the same for the career and technical school scholarship. There is the curriculum, there's the assessment score, and there is the grade point average with regard to it. The career and technical schools will be certified by the Department of Labor in dialogue with the Department of Education. So in order for a student to use it at a career and technical school in Alaska, that school would have to be approved by the Department of Labor, giving the criteria listed in the law for that evaluation. We don't want to fund schools that pop up overnight and say that we're here to teach. We want to make sure that the schools offer a valid program that's related to training our workforce in Alaska.
Mr. Chairman?
Representative Edgemon.
Following the line of questioning that Representative Gardner was pursuing a few moments ago, for the career and technical school scholarships, boy, it just sure seems intuitively or at first blush that 4 years in math, 4 years in language arts, science, and social studies for somebody who wants to become a diesel mechanic or a beautician or something, that's pretty rigorous. I guess I'd like to hear the rebuttal on why that is, and maybe outside of the mantra of education reform, because, you know, I mean, from a practical standpoint, that seems that's a pretty high bar.
To the Chair, Representative Edgemon, you know, students in Alaska are required to complete 2 years of math. They usually do that their freshman and sophomore year, and many of them, especially if they do not like math, do not take any more math. Okay. Mm-hmm. During that time, many of them forget what they've learned because they don't practice it, and it's not something that they apply to their daily life. And I think that if you talk to a diesel mechanic, they will tell you how much math is involved in being a diesel mechanic. But we're looking at courses that are directly related to success in a profession. Technical reading, you know, applied math, you know, math for the welder. I mean, there's lots of technical math courses out there. These are not courses that we're not requiring a student to go through and take calculus for the career and technical program. We will develop a set of courses, and many districts already have these, by the way, so this is not new ground. Instead of physics for science, you could be taking power mechanics. Certainly something a diesel mechanic would want to know. With regard to other occupations that they might enter, I think it's important that consumer skills, business math, may be important in this particular track. We're not trying to create an elitist track, but a rigorous track. And we believe, and most career and technical folk will tell you, you need 4 years of math. It's not like it was when I was going to school. Math is important. Science is important. That's just applied math and logic and the ability to communicate. When you talk to employers about what they want, some of the top things that they want students to know and be able to do is to read technical information and to understand it and apply it, to write it and to understand and apply it, and problem-solving skills, all of which are taught in these specific disciplines. So I think that the rigor of the career and technical education scholarship, which is what we're trying to invite students to engage in, it should be rigorous, although some states do it differently.
And I had a question on this. I'm going back and forth. I mean, if someone is has gone through the first set, the academic scholarship, they can, depending on what school they go to, is going to be what scholarship they would get. In other words, let's say we have someone that went through and qualified with a 3.5 and then decided to go to Avtech, or I forget the other names of the other certificate or degree programs, or welding programs, or commercial equipment operator programs. They would still qualify. This isn't going to be exclusive, but they would qualify for the amount of the career and technical award. Is that up to that amount? Is that correct or not?
Chair Seaton, if a student is using the career and technical education scholarship, there's one level, and that's up to $3,000 a year for 2 years. If they qualify for a gold level scholarship, they can use that at the university or as one of the university or college in Alaska that is regionally accredited. So if you qualify for a gold and you go to a career pathway, because you're going to be going to an institution approved by the Department of Labor, that would only qualify for the career and technical scholarship. They're two different things. The silver, gold, and platinum scholarships are for regionally accredited colleges and universities in Alaska. The career technical one is available for training institutions approved by the Department of Labor, and that's for $3,000. And you can only take one or the other. So if a child gets the highest level, if they qualify for the highest level and they want to be a welder, then they would go through the career track because the welding program would be that type of program.
Okay, but what I'm hearing is there's two matrices of courses that qualify for the math, the science, and everything.
Yes.
Is the intention that the career track will include all of the courses selections from the academic track, so that if someone goes through and gets a gold academic, doesn't want to go to the University of Alaska or another situation and wants to become a welder or something, that they can use that scholarship not at the level of the gold, but at the level of the career tech at the career tech center. I just want to make sure that we have crossover here.
I understand the question now, and the answer is absolutely. A student who qualifies under the gold would be able to meet all the curricular requirements for the career tech.
Okay, thanks. And Representative Munoz.
That doesn't seem quite fair, though. When you look at the cost of attending the UA is at $14,000 compared to the AVTEC at $15,775. And if a student meets the requirements of the GOLD program but wants to go into a career tech field, it seems that they are not awarded in the same way that a UA student is. So I think, there might be, a little bit of unfairness in the way that it's structured.
We'll look at that as we go through. And that is something to analyze if you're qualifying for something, and if the cost of the program that you're going into is at a certain level, are we going to say that we're going to only give you that qualification if you go to the University of Alaska or APU instead of offsetting the same amount that you are going to have to pay to go through an electrician school? So that's a good point, and I maybe you guys can think about that and come back to us and see where we go. Okay, let's move on if there are no further questions on this point. Okay. And it's taken us a while to get through, so you got to, we're thumbing back and forth. Are we on page 7?
I'm on page 7, section 1443.827, maximum awards and allowable uses.
Okay.
I think that,
great place.
I think just to highlight a few points under number 1, for the merit-based academic scholarship, 3 tiers of scholarship financing awards, the highest tier of award per semester must be equal to the cost of approved tuition at the University of Alaska in school year 2010-2011. So we set the amount by law over the tuition that a student will pay next year. Okay, and it will stay that way until the law was changed, and that's for 15 credits a semester, is the way it's set right now. And the GOLD is 100% of the tuition cost for 15 credits on 2010-2011. The platinum is at that level. The gold award is 75%, and the silver is 50%. And as was noted, the merit-based career and technical scholarship is limited to $3,000 per year.
Before we go on, it says the top level is that for 15 credits. It doesn't say anything about the number of credits for the second tier or the third tier. Is this meaning that all 3 tiers have a 15-credit requirement?
Yes, Chair Seaton.
Okay.
Mr. Chairman?
Representative Edna.
On that section, Commissioner, why would you tie the rates to 2010 and 2011? Why would you not just sort of take that out of the statute and give the department more flexibility? With the tuition increases, a much higher rate of inflation every year.
Through the chair, Representative Edgeman, the thought in designing it, we didn't want the cost of the program or the draw on the account to be based on decisions by the Board of Regents.
And just for everybody's note, we will probably ask to have that for a student taking 15 credits be moved up before the sectioning, so it's clear that everyone's required to take 15 credits, not just the first tier. Representative Gardner.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, I don't read that as saying the student's required to take 15 credits. I read that as part of determining the cost of tuition. The cost of tuition for 15 credits is X amount in this year. And we heard testimony during the interim when we had a hearing about how in systems where the universities can independently raise tuition, a scholarship that's not pegged to a certain amount of money has the unintended consequence of encouraging universities to dramatically increase their tuition because they get a whole bunch more money from the state if they do that. So that's the reason for having it pegged to a certain volume. That since the scholarship's for 8 semesters, a student who takes it at 12 semesters, goes through at 12 units a semester, will have to pay more themselves at the other end.
Appreciate that. I guess I was I don't see then a requirement that there's a minimum number that you have to take. There's a part-time student, but would you, is it in there or do we need to put it in there?
No, it's in there. If we go down through the law, you'll see where that relates to.
That's fine.
But the way the 15 credit and the tuition on 2010 works is that the university charges by credits. It used to be, at least when I remember going to school, a full-time student was 12 credits, and then if you took more, there was an increase in tuition. It's not that way anymore. And so in trying to determine the maximum amount, we took 15 credits times the credit requirement, or the cost per credit based on 2010, 2011, and that is the amount that the scholarship would be tuned to pay. Now, I will point out, although you haven't asked it, I believe many bachelor's degrees require 130 credits to graduate, and if a student takes 15 credits per semester for 4 years, that's 120. So there's a 10-credit gap there with regard to the program. Okay, I'm trying not to be redundant here as we move down, so if I skip anything, just pull me back. On line 19, item B, a part-time student who receives a merit-based
Wait a minute, we're wrapping up, Wilson?
I want to go back up. To number to two, thank you, Mr. Chairman.
To which line are you on which page?
Line 13 to 15.
Okay.
I just don't think it's quite fair to not exceed that $3,000 a year when we do it with the other kids. I mean, you know, especially when it's costing more. So I think we need to look at that. I want to flag that.
Through the chair, Representative Wilson, Representative Benyos, ask the chair to ask us to do a sheet on that, and we're going to do that and respond to that. It's a good question.
Thank you.
Okay, under item line 19, a part-time student who receives a merit-based academic scholarship and is enrolled at least on a half-time basis is eligible for an award on a pro-rata basis. And so we do allow students to utilize their scholarship potential on a part-time basis, which I think is a benefit to students. Okay, and we've talked about
and our definition of a part-time student, or are we getting down to full-time student later? Where the number?
For the chair, we're going to have to respond back to you on that question.
Okay, because I just haven't found the numbers, so.
My initial answer is that we would respond to anything that's under 12 credits at the university is usually considered a part-time status, just so you know. But they may have changed that, too, since I attended, so I will get back to you specifically. Okay, item line 25D, the student is eligible for up to 8 semesters of enrollment at a qualified university or college, which may include graduate courses, which we think is a benefit. The student's eligible with the Career Technical Scholarship for 2 years. And you may not receive both an academic and a Career Technical Scholarship.
So a student can, under line 19, can use a part-time scholarship. And is that you have 8 semesters of part-time or 8 semesters of full-time within 6 years, but is utilization of a part-time a semester?
Through the chair, is my interpretation, and we'll clarify that if it's not, that the use of part-time students would be pro rata on the semester, so they have 6 years to. I'm going to have to get back to you.
That's another flag we just need to.
Yep. Good question.
We want them to get through.
Okay, do we have questions on. Representative Munoz.
Page 7, line 8, we would establish in statute the date at 2010 or 11 through 11, so we might want to take that out because the the program is presumably going to move forward based on the tuition in any given year, not that specific year.
Representative Munoz, the idea is to set a dollar amount for the tuition, because whether the legislature sets the tuition or whether the university regents set the tuition, there are incentives, and we've seen that in Louisiana, where the legislature set the tuition, didn't want to pay more, so they just kept the tuition of the university really low. And so all the other students, I mean, the university's budget had a big hole in it because I think it was Louisiana, the legislature wanted to keep the funding low. And then there have been other cases where the university regents had control of the tuition. And when they were getting a whole lot of state money coming through, then they raised the tuition level and automatically made the state pay a whole lot more. And so that's what that is. It seems like we could actually calculate the dollar amount and put that in there instead of making this calculation. And that might be something that we want to look at to avoid confusion. Any other questions at this point? Okay, proceed.
On page 8, item number 4, program standards. Subject to B of this section, the department shall establish program standards for the program. We reviewed that. But under item B, I think, is a very, very important part of this program. The department shall establish a maker procedure or alternative pathway for students who are not eligible for a scholarship to make up a deficit by alternative means. Excuse me. If the deficit was caused by circumstances that would make it unfair not to allow the student to make up the deficit. The department may not waive a requirement and shall require the student to achieve a result comparable to that required by other students. The decision of the department regarding a student's eligibility for alternative means is final. In determining circumstances in which the student may pursue alternative means, the department shall consider the fairness to students who have met the requirements and the need to promote the goals of the program. Attendance at a high school outside of the state is not a circumstance in which fairness requires that a student be allowed to pursue alternative means to qualify for a scholarship. Circumstances in which the department may allow a student to pursue alternative means to qualify for a scholarship include the following. The required curriculum was not reasonably available to the student because the student attended a small and remote high school in the state. The deficit was caused by rare and unusual circumstances outside the control of the student. I believe that in some of the questions today asked regarding the participation of kids in rural Alaska and urban Alaska underlie the challenges that we have before us to make this fair to all students. They're significant. The challenges in rural Alaska in particular are significant to make sure that every child is successful. Most of our intervention districts that we're working with are in rural Alaska. The difficulties for one or two teachers to deliver programs by themselves are hard. They're there. They're real. And what we want to do is to provide an alternative pathway when circumstances beyond the control of the student dictate. The student could apply to my office, and through a mechanism established by the department or under regulation, we would design an alternative pathway for these students. And I like what it talks about, the standard of fairness. Now, many times laws are proposed to make it easy on us, black and white. Everybody fits. This was inserted, realizing that not everybody fits into everything. It's important to note, though, that this alternative pathway is not a waiver. It's not a waiver of the requirements. What it does is requires us to sit down and look at the individual circumstances of a student and to develop a plan for them to achieve it. Some of the alternative scenarios, it's hard to predict. A student missed a test because of weather or a death in the family. We may give them more time. A student who was not able to take the course before graduation, and we've determined that it's not just that it's real, We may give extra time to make up that course before we determine their eligibility, even after graduation, if necessary. Our intent, though, is not to waive the requirements, but to find a way for the student to achieve them. And we think that's important. And we think this grants the flexibility because it gives two criteria. The required curriculum was not reasonably available to the student because the student attended a small or remote high school in the state. That gives time for us to retool, regroup, redirect resources to make sure that every child has that available. You'll notice also that in this law, it requires that we report to the legislature every year, you know, who's attending, where these scholarships are going, what problems we're running into, so that you can adjust, if necessary, the law or give direction to the state board through other laws.
Go ahead.
I just want to indicate that item two is sort of the catch-all, because, you know, as a principal and administrator, and I think most of my colleagues would agree, it's almost impossible to predict what goes on in a child's life and what affects them. And this gives us a chance to sit down. Somebody mentioned the other day, that's going to be a lot of work on my office. But one of the things that commissioners get to do is to redirect, you know, resources, if you will. And I would probably put together a panel to weigh these cases and develop individual plans for these circumstances. And it is in recognition of the difficulty of what we're trying to do here to reform education in the state of Alaska through this program. So,
okay. Representative Gardner.
Thank you. I know we've talked about this, and I can't remember if it was a conversation between you and me or if it was actually in this committee about a student having the opportunity to retake the SAT or the ACT if they don't meet the minimum. And I don't think that is addressed in this paragraph, because it says if the deficit's caused by circumstances that would make it unfair. And we're talking about a student who maybe just had a bad day and says, I know I can do better and I'm going to take it again at my own expense. So is there some other place in legislation that's addressed, or does this need to be modified to clarify that a student who really can on their own time and at their own dollar improve their score on a qualifying exam if they missed a cutoff?
Through the chair, Representative Gardner, I believe that this includes that possibility. A student can take the ACT pretty much as many times as they want, you know, every time it's offered, starting from the first time they take it all the way through graduation. But I do believe that sometimes, again, circumstances beyond the control of the student may merit extra time to make up the exam. I see that as a possibility. I don't want to limit what those possibilities are, because every time you think you've seen everything in education, you find out you haven't seen it. So, but I do believe this gives us the flexibility to respond to assessments. And because if the student did not have access to the curriculum, it will affect their performance on the test. So you have to look at the whole full meal deal here if you're going to use the standard of fairness.
Chair.
Representative Edgman.
Well, I want to thank the commissioner for your emphasis on the section of the bill, because I think it is very important for those smaller school districts. There's just no question about that. I think this is really a key piece of making this whole concept work. That said, I guess for purposes of discussion, I'm sitting here wondering, you know, I sit on the resources committee, for example. We have put into law or put into statute that you had to have a panel. I mean, yeah, that it wasn't up to the discretion of the individual commissioner. I guess I'd like to hear your thought that or your argument why that maybe this broader language is more appropriate than maybe having some more specific language that might actually make it put into statute what we want the commissioner and preceding commissioners to do relative to this section of the bill, or how this would be conducted.
Well, through the chair, Representative Edgman, it's been, again, I'm not an expert on this, but again, the scenarios are very different, and if we put specific language in, it will preclude somebody that doesn't fit into those circumstances. But I think it's important to note that, again, this is not a waiver. They still have to meet, you know, all the curriculum requirements, the testing requirements that we establish, and the grade point requirements. This would be just an alternative pathway that if we found that through circumstances beyond the control of the student, they were not able to meet the requirements in the way we envisioned, that we would design an alternative pathway for them to meet them, or I think it says establish something of equal value.
And I think that we should recognize that we can put in language that it, that are including certain item, but not li- but it doesn't limit it to them. So we have that ability to do as well if that's, if that works there. Did you have a follow-up or?
Well, just a quick comment, yeah. Mr. Chairman. Obviously, we want to strike the right balance here. We don't want to tie the commissioner's hands inappropriately. But it certainly, in my part, bears a little bit more thinking in terms of whether or not we want to have something that establishes a system here in the framework that, if you had 100 kids a year that hit this, fit this category or whatever, that's a fair number of kids. And I mean, do you want to have a panel in statute and you've got to have a certain amount of representation? Maybe you don't. But I definitely want to think more about it.
Okay, and we can think about that. One other thing before we go to Representative Book is, does number two include special education accommodation?
Excuse me?
Does number two include special ed accommodations? I mean, this is why I think that we kind of need to set out some frameworks as to what this does or doesn't include, because I can see a circumstance where you could have a great amount of waivers proposed to you and going through administrative determination, even though it says it's a final determination. Those don't always mean that that's the final determination, where we have due process and all those other things. So, does two include special ed accommodations, and would those be for physical factors, or are those for what kind of things would those be?
Chair Seaton, what I will do is send you some information regarding the responsibilities under special ed law.
Okay.
I want to be careful I don't misanswer there at this point in time. It's an area that needs special consideration, but there's no requirement that we, under special ed law, that we open up pathways, that lower requirements to achieve a goal. But I will respond to that.
And I'm not even talking about lowering requirements. I'm just talking about the expectation the public might have reading this as to what qualifies for the application for a waiver. So you can get back to us, but we need to know what that intends to mean anyway. Representative Book.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just following up on this discussion, your words just a few minutes ago were, Commissioner, I'm not trying to put words in your mouth, but you said probably create a board. So given the opportunity for you to think through and give us something in design fashion that we can deal with.
Through the chair, Representative Book, we will do that. I think that some of the comments by Representative Edgeman are well taken, and I think that if we can add a certain amount of specificity to what we mean in this, it may help, and we'll certainly take a look at that and come back to you with something.
Okay, thank you. Representative Munoz.
I have a question regarding the alternative pathway concept. Are you also thinking about working with students early in their high school career, like in the ninth grade, for instance, and working out this pathway well before graduation, or are we only talking about post-graduation?
Through the chair, Representative Bignoz, I envision that the regulations to support this will start requiring five-year plans for students, because for this to be successful in terms of inviting kids, we have to start early developing that dream with their families to talk about what they need and the pathways available to them. And we intend to do that. I don't think it will be effective unless we do that. And because we're really trying to, as Representative Gardner said a little while ago, affect, the dream that a child has. I also want to point out this waiver process, or not, excuse me, forgive me for using the waiver. This alternative pathway is not intended to provide a pathway to less rigor around the program. Indeed, it's just a recognition that not all students fit everywhere, and the pathway will lead to the same rigor that all that we expect all students to obtain to go through the scholarship. It's not a pathway to less rigor or less accountability, because that's the key to the program. But it does recognize that not all things fit. And we would be very careful to set up a process that people just didn't assume this was an automatic way, because this is designed to reform schools. And if schools can say, oh, well, we can just say we're not going to offer the course, and that's not going to be the way we want them to go. We want schools to change, and they are.
Okay. And before we go on, I wanted to recognize that we had a number of people, students from University of Alaska, who are online, have been listening, have provided us some documentation on analysis of the scholarships and what those parameters are in other states. But we're not going to be able to get to that testimony today, because we need to get the bill in front of us so we understand all the parameters first. And so I'm sorry we haven't been able to get to you. We will be taking this up on Monday again, and I'm not dismissing the meeting. I just wanted people online to know that we're not going to get to public testimony today on this bill. But Monday at 8 o'clock, we will be having our next meeting on this subject. So please call back in, and we do have written testimony. And if there's any other written testimony people want to send us in, so we have that when they give their oral testimony, that helps us as well. So excuse me for the interruption, Mr. Commissioner. Go ahead.
With your permission, Chair Seaton, I will move down on page 8 to line 23, qualified post-secondary institutions, and we've talked about a few of these. The following institutions are qualified post-secondary institutions: a university or college physically located in the state that is authorized to operate in the state. B, is accredited by Regional Accreditation Association.
Okay, and I think we have a question on from Representative Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. On lines 26 and 27, it says authorized to operate in the state under this statute, so I assume that's some college, but then it says exempt from authorization. Can you just tell us what that would be?
Those are good.
We'll get back. We'll have you get back to us on that.
Okay. And, where does it say?
That's on lines 26 and 27 on those, which are the accreditation or non-accreditations or whatever. The other question is physically located in the state. So, University of Phoenix online virtual school does not qualify under this program. Is that correct?
That is correct.
Okay. Just getting clarification on that. And I didn't mean to specify one particular university. There's a number of online universities. Okay. Proceed.
Thank you, Chair Seaton. And under line 29-2, a career and technical school program physically located in the state that has been included on a list of certified career and technical school programs received from the Department of Labor and Workforce Development. And we talked about that earlier today. And on page 9, under line 2, it just again establishes the partnership between the Department of Labor and Workforce Development and the Alaska Department of Education and Early Development to work together to establish the criteria to certify technical schools in the state. We feel a responsibility to make sure that qualifying schools deliver what we're paying for, or what students are paying for.
Mr. Chair?
Representative Booth.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Will that be in the form of an MOU, a letter of understanding, or what form will that take?
Through the chair, Representative Book, I believe that the law calls for them to carry that out, so there won't be an MOU as far as on how the Department of Education and the Department of Labor work together. We'd probably develop some kind of MOU that outlines those through the Department, the State Board of Education, and Department of Labor.
Thank you.
This is basically establishing a statutory requirement for consultation between the two departments on the development of those criteria. Is that correct?
Yes, sir. Okay.
Thank you. And before we go on, programs that are not internships, what do you, Representative Booth, what do you, apprentice programs, those kind of things, are those included in this, or is this, does this eliminate apprenticeship programs?
Chair Seaton, I do not believe that it eliminates them if they are approved programs under the criteria established by law. We would be leaving that up to the Department of Labor to establish what is a program. But I have to tell you that we haven't carried out the analysis, so we'll go back and take a look at that. That's the first time that question has come up.
Okay, if you would, thank you. And Representative Book.
On that point, there are established criteria with the Department of Labor and Workforce Development, and as mentioned on page 8, line 29, I think if you look, there are already established, and then I think it carries forth on the next page, on the top, the line 1, as to when they're going to take effect. So
I just want to get the clarification, because that says school programs in both cases, and I just want clarification on whether we're talking about apprenticeship programs that are. So
you might want to take the word out.
Well, I don't know. We'll get the Department of Labor and the department here will come back with a memo on us, showing us what they intend to be the parameters of that. Is that your understanding as well?
Yes, Chair Seaton, we will get back to you on that with clarification. Okay. It's a good question, and we haven't thought of it, and we'll work on it.
Okay, we're on line 17.
Post-secondary institution is physically located in the state if the campus, teachers, classrooms, school administrators, and equipment used to provide the education of students are physically present in the state. Use of virtual, electronic, or online materials by teachers in the state does not disqualify a post-secondary institution, even if the materials are generated outside of the state. However, a correspondence, virtual, electronic, or online program that is administered from outside the state is not physically located in the state, even if the program is delivered by teachers or equipment in the state.
Okay.
As we move down, section 1443.840 talks about the application of the award and the role of the commission. I think it is important to note under 27B, payment of a scholarship is subject to appropriation. If insufficient funds are appropriated to pay all eligible scholarships, the commission shall pay existing awards on a pro rata basis. It's a tough one, but it's important that it be there.
And Mr. Chair?
Yes, Representative Edmund.
And just to underscore the obvious point, the commissioner had mentioned it, establishing this contract between the student and the school and the scholarship and higher performance standards. I just want to underscore that this is, as well, sort of one of those sleeper provisions of the bill that's pretty doggone important.
Thank you, Chair Seaton. Through Chair Seaton, Representative Edgman, I think you're absolutely right. Some of the information from other states that have instituted programs indicates that they have always fully funded their scholarships. And the contract, of course, would always last 6 years from the date that you don't fund, because that's how long we're granting eligibility.
Representative Wilson.
If I was a student and had really slaved away at this, because that's what some of them will feel like, but they know that they'll get a college education because someone has promised them this. Man, if we don't do this, that is bad. I mean, I think we need to think about this, because if it doesn't get done, we are letting a lot of people down, and in a time when they have worked probably harder than they've ever worked in their life up to this time. So I hope that it sure never would happen. Goodness.
And it's kind of similar to the 70-30 reimbursement for bond debt reimbursement. There has been one time in the state's history where we didn't fully appropriate the money to do that. I mean, it's a 20-year commitment, basically. The bonds are sold, and you're making a commitment to do that over the life of those bonds. It's difficult, but we need to have either in here that it's pro rata for the kids that have worked for this and that are coming up and that haven't received their scholarships get nothing, and we fund the ones that are first in, first out. There needs to be some mechanism to recognize the constitutional obligation for an appropriation by the legislature. And so, you know, if somebody has a different attitude, we can look at an amendment. So, you know, we're after 10. I wish we were to the end. We're not quite. We have a few more pages. I think that those are going to go more rapidly, but not rapidly enough for today. We do have one major subject that we've asked the, well, we've got more than one, but we've got one major one on looking at a needs-based component that we've asked them to bring back to us as well. I know some members have been developing some information and some components on that as well, so we will take this up on Monday at 8, and we will hopefully have our people from our students that we'll be able to call back in, and we will make sure that all committee members have the testimony from the students so that they can look at that over the weekend as well. So with that, it is 10:05, and we will be adjourned.